And Nigel Hampton KC represented Peter Ellis at his first appeal and kept in contact with him up until his death, and he joins us now. Kia ora, Nigel. This must be a pretty bittersweet moment, this judgment.
Well, it is. I mean, I don't consider it that way personally, but it certainly is in relation to Peter and his family, bittersweet for them, and an acknowledgement to Peter. He was utterly composed in relation to this in his dying days. He remained composed. He went to his death saying that even though he would not know the ultimate outcome, he knew inside himself where the truth lay.
So there were multiple appeals in this case, Governor-General involved, a ministerial inquiry, a request for a prerogative of mercy, all the way to the top court in the land. I mean, how could the legal system have got it so wrong? These are supposed to be fail-safes, aren't they?
Well, it's a human system. Human frailty exists in whatever system you like to think about, Lisa. One of the good things to come out of Peter's case, not directly but indirectly, the creation for the last 2 and a bit years of a criminal cases review commission, which looks at miscarriages of justice and would hopefully have been able to correct the Peter Ellis case long before, if it had been in existence, would have corrected it long before we had spent 30 years waiting for it to happen.
So what have you learnt from today's judgment? What have we learnt?
What have we learnt? Great care must be taken by prosecutions and by courts in allowing, particularly in jury trials, expert evidence. It is too easy for expert opinion evidence to overspill the bounds of known science, to overstep or overstretch, and go beyond what should be allowed. And that's what has been found to have happened here. And B, as well as overstretching the bounds of the known science, here an expert who is supposed to be objective and helping the court is seen to have been involved at various stages before the trial itself, before the arrests even, involved in the interviewing of children, of looking at those interviews, of recognising contamination, but cross-contamination, but taking steps, as it were, to cover that over. And in fact, in a letter of August of 1992, pointing out those difficulties, but failing to be disclosed to the to the defence.
So there were proper boundaries, Nigel, around the duties of this expert witness, who was in fact involved, as you say, in many facets of the case.
Yeah.
Okay. What about the evidence of children? Can we ever rely on the memories of young children to convict someone? Should we?
We can, but not in the sort of circumstances that occurred here. It's got to be extraordinarily carefully handled. It can't be subject to the sort of prolonged and continual questioning that these children were subjected to. The number of interviews they underwent of themselves would have anchored material in their memories that were not, which was not necessarily true or accurate material. So contamination comes from many sources, and came from many sources here in terms of parental influence, of continual questioning, of children talking about these things between themselves even.
Now, I ask this, Nigel, because it's an incredibly complicated field, right? And in this particular case, I think there were more than 100 kids interviewed. About 20 of them claimed some kind of abuse. And aside from some of the more fantastical allegations, there were some consistent claims running through the statement. So is it really possible that that many children, all of their evidence could be contaminated?
If you went through, as the court, the Supreme Court did on this occasion, if you went through the history and the history leading up to the police involvement, then the police involvement and the interviewing that took place, the multiple interviews and the attitudes of parents in relation to these matters, and the fantastical nature that developed in terms of the content of the interviews, you would say that there was not, in any respect, the degree of reliability that would be needed to found a criminal prosecution.
The nuance matters in this case, Nigel, so this is an important question. Does this mean, this ruling, that Peter Ellis is innocent, or does it mean that he just didn't get a fair trial?
It is nuanced, but the bottom line is that there's been a substantial miscarriage in relation to the evidence, in relation to contamination, and in relation to some aspects of fairness of trial. It means that those convictions are set aside, but there's no resounding claim of Peter being able to walk from the court an innocent man, if he could walk from the court, because that's not what the system is. The system is looking at whether there was a fair trial, and has concluded that this was not a fair trial.
Okay, and the other thing at issue here then is, were these children abused at all?
Well, again, that's a nuanced and multi-level question.
Indeed,
I would say, from my looking at and reading of the interviews and of how those developed and the content of those interviews, I would say not. But on a second level, how this was handled and the processes through which these children have been put over many a year, that is in itself an abuse of those children.
Really appreciate your time this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. That is Nigel Hampton, KC, there, speaking about the Ellis case.